Using the is this stressful? Is this need perception of material? Can you do that outside of states of job? How far developed do you have to be in order to apply those kinds of questions?
You can actually apply those concepts of inconstancy, stress, and that's all from the very beginning. Like if you're sitting there in concentration and this thought of something comes up, it says, okay, the pleasure I get out of this, is this constant? No. Why do I want to go there? Is it stressful to think about this? Yes. Why do I want to go there? There's that passage I told you where the Buddha is teaching breath meditation to Rahula. And he actually teaches them not self and inconstancy as meditation, even before he starts with breath. The purpose here being that anything that comes up that's not part of your concentration, you want to let go. So you apply it to that. You can apply it to kind of daily life issues. Do I really want to go there? No. Okay, learn to look at it as stressful, learn to look at it as inconstant, and have that value judgment in mind. Where it really goes deep is when you've gotten hooked on jhana. You know, I know some people say, well, this is awfully pleasant stuff, but I'm afraid I'm going to be attached. And you also, sometimes you actually hear Dharma teachers say, don't do this kind of practice because you'll get attached. And the Buddha's basically saying, okay, get attached, and then you'll use that attachment to help peel away your attachment to other things. And this is a very innocuous attachment. As long as you don't want to measure yourself against other people. And two, as long as you begin to realize, okay, I still have to do my work. I still have to live my life. I can't just, you know, hide off in some sort of jhana hole someplace. And it's okay. And when they talk about the dangers of attachment to jhana, there's nothing compared to the dangers of attachment to sensuality. People don't kill over jhana. They don't lie, they don't have illicit sex, they don't drink, they don't break the precepts over the jhana. So it's okay to get a little attached. Once you've got that attachment, then it's easier to peel away your attachment to other things and to apply this perception of not self. Because if you're not feeling a sense of well-being inside, it's very hard to let go of someplace where you've gotten your pleasure in the past. In fact, there's a passage where it says, if you don't have this internal kind of pleasure, you're going to keep going. Even though you see the drawbacks of sensuality, see all these drawbacks, you're still going to go back. There's a folk tale they have in Thailand about this deva who was friends with this guy who gets reborn as a dog. And so he feels sorry for the dog, and so he turns the dog into a prince. And here's this princess meets up with the prince, and she falls in love immediately. The deva did a really good job. Except for one thing, the dog still had a few dog habits. And so the princess brings the prince home and insists that she's got to marry him. No matter how the parents say, wait a minute, where does this prince come from? Who's his, you know, who's his family? What kingdom? She says, I don't care. He's a prince and I love him. So they finally give in. And then one night she finds him in the bathroom eating shit out of the toilet. She realizes this is not a real prince. So even though you may understand the drawbacks of sensuality, sometimes you still go back. So you need this pleasure of the jhana. And you use that pleasure to peel away your attachment to other things. Then you turn around and you apply those perceptions of the jhana itself. And that's when you have a chance to get awakening.
I don't know if this question would make any sense, but can you conclude then that the state of combining the deathless is constant, unstressful, and self?
It's constant, unstressful, but at that point you have no sense of self. And no sense of not-self. Because, you know, what is your sense of self? It is that the self is producer, the self is consumer. Those are perceptions. Now, there are no perceptions in there. Now, there is a pleasure, the Buddha says, but it's not a feeling of pleasure. It's a pleasure that comes totally independent of fabrication, totally independent of the aggregates. There is a consciousness which is also independent of the aggregates. And it's not going to change. As we get down to the next passage, we'll talk about, you know, what it is to be fabricated, what it is to be unfabricated. Your sense of self is a tool. Not self is also a tool. It's a perception. And what you're doing is anything that you see is a... And again, you want to learn how to do these... It's a fabrication. You want to learn how to do them skillfully. So if you see that you develop as a perception of self around a certain desire that's unskillful, you want to disassociate with that. You want to disidentify. If it's a useful perception for the path, you continue with that sense of self until it doesn't, you don't need it anymore. In which case you let go of both tools. You don't need the not-self tool, you don't need the self tool. You put your tools down. So you can conclude that it is constant and it is pleasant. Although constant implies that it's in time, and this is actually outside of time. Okay, we'll move on to the next one. But the Buddha talks about what's unfabricated and fabricated. Okay, and something that's fabricated, arising is discernible, passing away is discernible, alteration or otherness while staying is discernible. So if you experience anything at all in life, you have to realize, okay, you played a part in its fabrication. If there's any arising, any passing away, or any change. That's a pretty radical statement. That there's an element of your intention in that experience. Now the test for something unfabricated is there's no arising, no passing away, and no alteration. Okay, that's what's unfabricated. So that's the quality that you're looking for.
Does that apply to like really sort of obvious things like here I am sitting next to you, and so what part have I played in the fabrication of my experience of sitting next to you?
Okay, well just think about the fact of seeing her sitting next to you. There's a lot of attention that goes into that. You've probably heard about cases where they've performed operations on people who've been blind from birth. They actually give them sight, and they find it very confusing because their brain hasn't developed the processing abilities. So that intentional element of the processing, you recognize that's a person.
The translation inside of me from the visual gate of the sense gate to my experience.
So as an element of fabrication comes there.
Thank you.
So should we talk about the unfabricated for a bit? Here the Buddha gives a list of synonyms for the unfabricated. Some of them are a little strange, so we'll have to explain them. Okay, whatever is the ending of passion, ending of aversion, the ending of delusion, that is called, the unfabricated. In other words, there's no element of intention that goes into it. The next one is unbent. They talk about the mind bending or leaning in a particular direction. In this case, when the mind, this state doesn't lean in any direction at all. In other words, it does not create anything. It does not act as a cause for anything. Which is the reason why we cannot say that nirvana is the one from which all things come and the one from which they all return. That's not a Buddhist teaching. It's a Taoist teaching. Nirvana doesn't lead to anything. Effluent free. The word effluent, asava, we had it up ahead above a little bit, we didn't explain it though. It means things that flow out of the mind, particularly sensuality, becoming, and ignorance. Okay, none of that is present. The true, in other words, it is not deceptive in any way. The beyond, the subtle, the very hard to see. This talks about how difficult it is to perceive this, to attain it. Ageless, permanence, the undecaying. Surfaceless, okay. What does that mean? There's an image in the canon where the Buddha talks about a ray of light. The surfaceless applies to a type of consciousness. Now most of your consciousness has a surface, in other words, it bounces off something. you see the person sitting in the back, or I see the person sitting in the back of the room, okay, you're the surface against which my consciousness bounces. But this doesn't have anything it bounces against. And it gives the Buddha gives the analogy of a sunbeam that comes through the eastern window of a house. And he says, if it comes through the eastern window of the house, where does it land? And the monks say, it lands on the western wall. What if there's no western wall? Okay, then it'll land on the ground. What if there's no ground? It lands on the water under the ground. There's this belief that the earth floated on an ocean. What if there's no water? Because it doesn't land. It's not established anywhere. In other words, as long as there's no surface at that point, there's no object to this consciousness. And like a light beam that doesn't have an object, it's not luminous. The reason we see light is because it's reflecting off of something. But this doesn't even have a luminosity, it's just totally clear. Totally clear and free of objects. Non-objectification. Okay? Remember we talked about objectification as being a type of thinking in which you think in terms of who am I and what particular world of experience. Because none of that goes on there.
Isn't that subjectification?
Well, you're making yourself into an object. You are now a thing. And when you become a thing, you become a being. Beings need to feed. But at this point, there's no more need to feed. That's another implication of non-objectification. There's nothing that has to feed. Nothing to feed on. Peace, the deathless, the exquisite, bliss, rest, the ending of craving, the amazing, the astounding, secure, security, unbinding. The word unbinding is the word that they used for when a fire went out. We talked a little bit earlier about how fire clings to its fuel and feeds on its fuel. And their belief at that time was that when fire went out, it's not like it went out of existence, it just stopped acting. There was this fire property that was kind of diffused through everything. And when it got agitated, or when it got aggravated, or sort of provoked, it would flame out. But if there's no provocation, it would die out. And why did it die out? Because it let go. And so the unbinding here is basically the message of unbinding is that freedom comes from letting go. As opposed to what Janis Joplin said. The unafflicted, and there's no suffering there at all. Dispassion, purity, release, attachment free. Here's a whole series of ones that give a sense of the protection. There's island, shelter, harbor, refuge. And it's the ultimate. And the way leading to the ultimate, and on the other part, we get all these things, is the Eightfold Path. Do you have any questions about any of those terms from Nirvana? Anything strike you as especially strange or needing more explanation?
I'm finding myself mulling over what you touched on yesterday. The very concept of, well, if there's nothing doing, nothing gleaning, nothing to think about, what's so good about it? In fact, it is constant. I understand that intellectually. But when I try to kind of dangle a little, you know, cookie in front of myself, oh yeah, the deathless, I just kind of, what you touched on yesterday.
What's attractive?
Yeah. Why wouldn't I just want to be a saint here on earth, helping?
I'll give you two examples. One is a little kid says, Mommy and Daddy, why do you sit there and listen to classical music? You're not jumping around, you're not dancing, you're not doing anything. What kind of pleasure is there in that? What do Mommy and Daddy say? Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah.
Trust me.
Trust me. Trust me, you'll like it. And the other one is basically, okay, even if you're a saint doing all these good things for people, you have to eat, you have to use Earth's resources. Mm-hmm. You need food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. all these things are going to cause a burden on other people, one way or another. This way you're no burden on anybody at all. Caroline, you got something?
No, I got it. So you say there's film of consciousness, it's just not our normal consciousness. And it's pure, it's like pure light, or what does that mean? It's like oxygen that we can't see, but we are it. Pure energy.
Well, the thing is, when you hit there, you realize this has been here all along. It's really, really nice, but you've been ignoring it. It's, oh my gosh. And that, you know, that when he says amazing, astounding, it really knocks you out. Okay. It's, wow, this, you know, I thought I was getting something cool by being a human being in Bellingham. It's cooler than that.
Oh, come on.
There's Vancouver. Or Victoria. And then the Buddha ends with the more helpful part. We can talk about these terms, but basically the how do you get there? You do it by following the Eightfold Path. And then he gives you encouragement. I've taught you the ultimate, the pathway, the ultimate. Whatever sympathetic teacher should do, seeking the welfare of his disciples out of sympathy for them, that I have done for you. Over there are the roots of trees, over there empty dwellings. Practice jhana monks, don't be heedless, don't let it fall into regret. This is our message to you all. Basically, it's not just talking about, well, how wonderful it is, this is how you get there. That's the important part of the teaching, is how to do it. And then passage 30 deals with that question. So when you get there, are you there for eternity free from disease, or do you not exist? And the Buddha says, when you've reached the end, there's no criterion or there's no measure by which anyone would say that, for you it doesn't exist. When all dharmas are done away with, all manner of speaking are done away with as well. So you can't talk about the person as existing, not existing, neither or both. Because when you define yourself by your attachments. And when there are no more attachments, there's no way to define you. And when there's no way to define you, you can't talk about you. In other words, you're totally unlimited. That's the other part that's really nice about it, is there's no limitations.
So can this deathless state exist within a body that is born, or
it's like tuning into a different dimension. When the Buddha talks about touching it with your body, it's where you're experiencing your body right now. That's where you're experiencing. It's nothing out there. It's right in here. You're right at the same place where you've been feeling pain and where you've been working from the inside. That's where it appears. And the teachers keep pointing back to that. It's this inside of you that you were working with. And the solution to the problem is also inside here as well. Which is why the Buddha can't bring his nirvana out to show people. John Mahabho makes this comment many times. And if you could take it out to show to people, he said, nothing else on the market would have any have any worth. This is what everybody would want. Mm-hmm. But it's a purely internal thing that we have to do for ourselves. And we do the work from the inside.
So at the end of 29, where he's pointing out the roots of the trees and the empty dwellings, he's saying, go sit.
Yeah, go sit. Good places to sit.
Mm-hmm. What would you recommend to just hoping or getting closer of jhana, but I feel like in grade 2, being in a class of grade 12, and we got the manual to fight off the pain. And so I just try to go in grade 3, and study, and
okay, well,
there's a chance not being a monk or a nun.
Okay, well, with, as I said, with the John Lee's instructions for how to get into jhana, I think those are the best ones out there. You know, working with the breath. It's okay. Whether it's jhana or not, I'm going to at least get some sense of gratification, sense of well-being out of the way I breathe. You start with that. And that becomes the hook that you hold on to. This is where the Buddha ends with instructions. Go practice jhana. Sometimes you see it translated as go meditate, but the verb again is that verb that goes with jhana. And so you don't, fortunately, you don't have to think the word jhana, 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 while you're doing just the breath, breath, breath. That's something you can actually focus on. That's where you start. I mean, learn how to feel comfortable in your own skin. Start there. And then if it's not quite comfortable enough, try to, once it starts getting comfortable, then try to get more demanding. I'm a little more comfortable than this. What can I do? That's how you advance.
So going on more involving and being a nun, or going in long retreats or something like that, helps a lot, or can we do
it? I mean, you can do it in daily life. It helps to go on a retreat every now and then to sort of charge things up. And then in your daily life, you want to create an environment which is conducive towards, you know, turning off TV, turning off the internet, all the other things that would distract you from how you're experiencing things from inside right now.
Ajahn Lee's instructions, are they in one of your books?
They're in the book, Keeping a Breath in Mind, which is available online.
Yeah.
I also like the instructions in With Each and Every Breath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Try those too.
So do you have to go through this, all the step of jhana to go to awakening, or?
Some people can do it just for the first. But you never know which one you're going to have to do, so you have to work on getting as good as you can.
Is that why there are stories about people just listening to the Buddha and going, okay?
Yeah, they go into the first jhana and bang, they're out.
Yeah. Well, I didn't catch what you're saying. This is on your plans, and you were talking about this. What you were saying is that's how you advance.
You focus on being comfortable in your skin, using your breath energy, your sense of the breath. That's where you start. And then the way you advance is you get more picky about how comfortable you want to be. Is this good enough? As the Buddha said, that the secret to his awakening was he did not rest content with his skillful states. We hear about contentment, contentment, contentment a lot in Buddhism. Well, that's basically contentment with your outside circumstances. Inside, you want to get good at what you're doing, and then you say, how can I do this better? Where can I find greater sense of stability, greater sense of security, greater sense of feeling really good here? And that puts the edge on of improving your skill. Questions for today? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Just wanted to ask about the Buddha. He was kind of despairing and trying to, you know, for 6 years of deprivation, and remembering that there was a state of experience as a younger person. I'm remembering that I've always found that part, that story, kind of odd.
Okay, the question in his mind at that point was, prior to that time, when he'd been a prince, he thought, okay, I'll find happiness by pursuing sensuality. Okay, when that didn't work, he did what happens to a lot of people who've been pursuing sensuality full blast, and turn around the other direction. Okay, let's go for pain. Can I train my mind just to no pleasure at all? Will that purify my mind? And he realized, okay, that extreme didn't work either. And the question was, he had tried sensuality, he had tried pain. Well, what's left? And he kind of searched through his memory. Well, here was this pleasure that was not connected with sensuality. Now, sometimes the question arises, well, when he was training with those other teachers, didn't they teach him high levels of concentration? They did. The thing is that you can get into those high levels of concentration without going through the jhanas, which may have been his case. And they also taught those as an end in and of himself. He came back to this, well, how about this? Maybe it's, instead of treating this as an end in and of itself, what if this is the path? Maybe this will lead me there, because that was the only alternative that was left. And then his next question is, why am I afraid of that? Because he spent 6 years, you know, running away from pleasure. And there's an element of fear that keeps you doing that. And the other is the element of pride. Look, I can take on this austerity that nobody else can take on. And for me, the amazing part of that story is his willingness to abandon that pride. So, okay, I'm willing to go back. And you know, the five brethren left him. They said, oh, he's gotten lazy, he's given up. You have to realize, okay, I don't care whether people respect me or not, I've got to do this. I've got to do this right. Yes?
That kind of feeds into what I want. That's what I feel that I have from the place, still, you know, that kind of thing you're talking about, definitely. There are flashes of them that are really pure and clear. But I don't seem to be able to stay with me.
Okay, go back to your breath. Because that's going to be your foundation. Everything gets founded on being centered right here in your body and learning how to stay very still and very calmly with that sense, that area of your sensation. Because you will have these other flashes of things, like in the different levels of concentration. But if you don't approach it systematically, it's like jumping up but then having to fall down again because you have nothing to support you. Whereas if you work on your just basic concentration skills and then get them more refined, eventually get to these states of equanimity that you can stick with, stay with. There's a story in Thai history that's related to that, the Buddha being abandoned by the five brethren. There were two brothers, Thai princes, who were Naresuan and Nekatasarot, their father, the king, had been defeated by the Burmese, and then they were taken over to Burma to be trained to be vassal princes. And there was a jealousy that developed between them and the viceroy of Burma. And the story goes that the jealousy got really bad when there was a thief in Burma who was holed up in the mountains, who had come down and plundered the countryside. And they decided to go out and send some troops out to deal with him. So the king thought this would be a good chance for the viceroy to show his stuff. They'd been trained in all the skills of being, you know, warrior princes. And so the Burmese viceroy takes a big army, leads him up the mountain, the bandit chief drives him back down again. And so Naresuan says, give me a try. And so the next time, Naresuan sends his very small force up the front of the mountain to lure the bandit chief down. In the meantime, he sends a bigger force up the back, captures the bandit chief. You can imagine what the viceroy felt about that. Mm-hmm. Years later, Naresu and his brother are allowed back to Thailand and told to be okay, to be good vassals. They get back and they declare independence right away. So the king, Burmese king, sends the viceroy in to show them a lesson. And the story goes that the Burmese were camped in Thailand, and Naresuan with his troops decide to do a morning attack, stealth attack on elephant. Now the idea of doing a stealth attack on elephant, I still have trouble visualizing. But he arrives at dawn in the Burmese camp, and as soon as the dust settles, he realizes that he's alone in the camp, that his troops haven't been able to keep up with him. So I mean, the Burmese could kill him. So what does he do? He sees the viceroy and he challenges him to a one-on-one duel. He says, the days of one-on-one duel are about over. Here's your last chance to show your honor that you really are a warrior. Mm-hmm. So the Burmese prince viceroy accepts the challenge. And so they have a battle, they have a duel, and it's kind of like, you know, the knights used to joust on horseback, well, they joust on elephant back. And the viceroy stabs the other guy with a spear. You see this all over Thailand. They have it embroidered on pillows, they have it on people's walls. Nice one, right there. And so, you know, by the time Narasimha was killed, the viceroy, then the Thai troops finally catch up, and they rout the Burmese, and this is how Thailand became independent. You can imagine this is a big deal in Thai history. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem was, Narasimha gets back to his city, and he's furious with his generals. He could have died. Mm-hmm. They let him, you know, they abandoned him, and he was alone in the Burmese camp. And so his plan is to kill off a couple of generals as a lesson. And this is when the one of the high-ranking monks who lived out in the forest outside of Ayutthaya says, I'd like to talk to you. Mm-hmm. And so the king goes out to talk to the monk, and he says, you know, when the Buddha gained his awakening, this was after the five brethren had left him. He was all alone under the tree. And it's part of the reason why we remember him was because he was all alone under the tree. Now, you are going to go down in Thai history for having defeated the Burmese single-handedly. Okay, we're not going to kill the generals. This is how you appeal to a king. That's how the story of the Buddha got used in Thai history. It's one of my favorite stories in Thai history. Any other questions? Any irrelevant questions? I've got a few minutes.
I think this is relevant, but in the main text, paragraph 2, is that seems quite a bit longer than the regular Satipatthana Sutta. Is that right? Versus, like, is there a Maha Satipatthana?
There's a Maha Satipatthana, yes. This is what it's taken from.
Okay. Because this has quite an extensive, you know, form of truth.
It's very extensive on the second and third verses. That's the big difference between the two. Except in the Thai edition, both versions are equally long.
Okay.
Questions? Okay, so the take home is, one, mindfulness is keeping something in mind. Mm-hmm. And the sutta basically gives you a series of frameworks to keep in mind so that you know what to do with your ardhasa. This is because your mind is an active agent. It's not just sitting there receiving things, it's actually out there shaping its experience. And so you need to remember things so that you can shape them well. These are some of the things to keep in mind. The duties basically keep the four noble truths. That's kind of the overarching structure. Keep the four noble truths in mind, and they give you your tasks for what to do. And that's what the truths are for. They are working the hypothesis. Both in the sense that you want to prove them, they're not proving the answer for you. And secondly, is you work with them. You give them instructions on what to do. They're not just there to be admired or affirmed or whatever. They're being put to use in analyzing your experience so you know what to do with it, so you actually can deal with this problem of suffering that you're creating yourself. You realize that you don't have to. That's the take home for the weekend. And if there are any books left in the back, you're welcome to take them. Mm-hmm. I'll be sending more to John as needed. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.